Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're in depth this hour with the next conversation in our criminal justice series. Today, the view on criminal justice from the county attorney for Minnesota's most populous county. Mike Freeman has served five non-consecutive terms as the prosecutor for Hennepin County. And although his office handles the prosecution of hundreds of cases each year, he's recently made headlines for declining to charge defendants in two big cases. And that's where we're going to begin. As Mike Freeman joins me this morning, I think your input would be valuable, too. If you've had experience as a defendant or a victim of a crime in Hennepin County, how satisfied were you with the criminal justice system overall? If you're a lawyer, an advocate, an administrator in the courts, what does the Hennepin County criminal justice system need to do to reform? So your personal experience, perhaps, with the criminal justice system as either a defendant or a victim of a crime. And if you're a lawyer or an advocate or an administrator, you work in the criminal justice system. What does the Hennepin County criminal justice system need to do to reform? Here's the number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Mike Freeman is with us from Minneapolis. And Mike, welcome. Sorry you couldn't be in the studio today, but I know the roads are a little rough, so good to have you on the phone.
It's great to be here, Kerry.
Mike, late last year, you decided not to charge two police officers in the shooting death of Jamar Clark, and you gave a recent speech about that decision, and you said that you thought the additional scrutiny that was being given to, quote, investigators, prosecutors, judges, and juries was appropriate. I'd ask you about some specific evidence that the scrutiny to investigators, prosecutors, judges, and juries has really changed anything in the way the criminal justice system works or the way you work?
Oh, I think it has. I think that since 2016, I think police officers in the state of Minnesota, I think prosecutors are more carefully considering the cases. They're scrutinizing them more directly. I know that in Hennepin County, now that I have eschewed the use for the use of grand juries, and I would have made a commitment to put all of our records online so everyone can view them, I think people are being a little bit more careful. And, you know, the criminal justice system is, in a democratic society, is open. The courtrooms are open. The decisions we make are open, and therefore we need to be very careful with how we scrutinize things and that we do a thorough, complete, and professional job. And if we need a little additional incentive, knowing that folks in the press are going to look at them and citizens are going to look at them, will make us do our job even better.
When you say people are being a little more careful, do you also mean police officers, and are officers or some of the police officers that you're working with telling you that this has had an effect in the way that they serve the community, for good or bad?
Well, first, Terry, no police officer ever wants to shoot anyone. This impacts the officers deeply. They're there to protect and serve. Sometimes they believe they must use force, deadly force. Lots of times they'll use lesser force. But it impacts their lives as well. And the scrutiny that's been given to police work, particularly in the last year or two, has reinforced to officers that they know everybody's watching them. And when people are watching you, normally you act a little better. Let me give you an example. I had a privilege of serving in the Minnesota Senate for 8 years in the 80s. And during that time, TV would come and cover us starting at 5 o'clock. The debate starting at 4 o'clock would be vigorous and perhaps a little less formal. But everybody looked at the clock, and suddenly, when we were on TV, we had our best manners on. Well, I think now all of us are trying to make sure our best manners are on all the time.
Mike, when the protests occurred following the death of Philando Castile, which, of course, was not in your county, But I know you're aware of it. Governor Dayton said he thought race was involved in the shooting. And I want you to listen to specifically how he put that. Here's the governor.
Would this have happened if those passengers, the driver and the passengers, were white? I don't think it would have. So I'm forced to confront, and I think all of us in Minnesota are forced to confront, that this kind of racism exists.
Do you think the governor's right?
I do not believe that there is very much, if any, direct racial bias. I think that there is a lot of implicit bias. Implicit bias is something we all carry, we know about, sort of, but we really don't, in which we treat folks that are a little different than us differently. Minneapolis police has gone through implicit bias training. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office has. And I think we've learned from that to be more wary and to be more careful. So I don't believe there's direct bias. I believe there's implicit bias.
Does that implicit bias, that recognition of it, influence the way you think about approaching cases, charging cases, not obviously not just in shootings where a police officer is involved, but in a, I mean, this kind of bias exists throughout the criminal justice system, doesn't it?
And this bias exists throughout society.
Okay.
I think we all treat people a little bit differently that don't necessarily look like us, come from the same background, have the same education. The first important part of resolving a problem, in my view, is recognizing it exists. And I think certainly we in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office are aware of this. Now, we've done some evaluations of our charging standards in the juvenile process, and we started there. And we were pleased after in-depth study done by the Council on Crime and Justice that found no difference in how we handled cases turning on the race of the suspect. We did find that African-American kids weren't doing as well in our diversion program as whites. When we dug a little deeper, okay. We realized that blacks were not getting the invitation to participate in diversion the same way whites were. They were all getting a letter, but the blacks weren't showing up. A number of them weren't. So now we've reached out. I mean, if your dentist can call you and tell you you're supposed to come to the dentist's office on Wednesday, we certainly can call these juveniles and remind them and their parents to come to court on Wednesday. Since we started doing that, the participation of African-American youth has increased, and it's virtually at the same level as it is for white kids.
How about, so that's participation. How about success rates through those diversion programs? The numbers that I've seen indicate that the young people of color, often young men of color, are not as successful in those programs as white kids are. What's your take on that?
The most recent statistics show that the gap has narrowed a good deal. The gap used to be bigger. I think we're getting them there now. We also have talked with the providers, and as we review what happens in diversion, we are trying to make sure that it is racially neutral as possible. It's also very clear when parents are involved, kids do much better in programs like this. And so we're doing a lot of outreach to make sure that parents are invited and strongly encouraged to participate.
I want to ask you about your decision on grand juries in officer-involved shootings. You made a decision in March to stop using grand juries in officer-involved shootings, which means that you didn't use one in your investigation into the actions of the police officers that were involved in the Clark shooting. I'd like to understand more about how you made that decision and why that, in your view, really makes a difference in the way justice is served in one of these officer-involved shootings.
The principal problem with grand juries is lack of transparency and lack of accountability. Let's take the latter first. Accountability, people want to know who's making the decision and who's responsible. And when you have a grand jury, by its nature, is 23 citizens who are anonymous. Nobody knows who this grand jury is. And that's difficult in today's demand for accountability. In the Jamar Clark decision, people know who made the decision. I did. And I will be held accountable for that in the next election. The next question is transparency. Mm-hmm. What happened? What information did I review to make the decision. Well, what I did at the same time I announced the decision and issued had a press conference and a speech, I put the speech online. I put a detailed 60-page report of the facts online. I put online every police report, every piece of forensic evidence, including the autopsy, the DNA reports. I put everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, then people could review it for themselves. They could review it and see what I saw. And it wasn't just me. It was people, skilled prosecutors and victim witness advocates in this office as well, giving me advice. But ultimately, people got to see everything we did. And then they can decide for themselves. And I think the subsequent response was positive. I think the amount of disclosure was unprecedented, at least in the state of Minnesota. And I think it helped people understand why I made the decision I did.
Would there be anything, even if the case went to a grand jury, would there be anything to prevent you from putting all of that information up anyway, after the grand jury made its decision?
I believe so. The law around the grand jury is complex. I think that there are problems with making full disclosure. I mean, Robert McCullough, a prosecutor in the Ferguson case, found a nuance in Missouri law that allowed it to go up. And he did. And he even released a grand jury transcript, which I know you can't do in Minnesota, to the general public. I felt this was more direct. I felt that there was a lack of faith or credibility in the grand jury. You know, there have been two very difficult decisions on officer-involved shootings in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
One was Jamar Clark, in which I declined prosecution, and one with Lando Castillo, in which John Choi in Ramsey County did charge. I know a little bit about Mr. Choi's case, and I believe he had no choice but to charge. I know my case very well. I had no choice but not to charge. And I think the fact that we are both providing a great deal of information will help gain public support for our very difficult decisions.
Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman is with us this morning as we continue our criminal justice series through the month. And we're asking him about some of the decisions that he's made on charging or not in some high-profile cases, of course, talking about the Jamar Clark case, a decision that he made to do away with the use of grand juries in officer-involved shooting cases, and then looking for his overall view on the equity in our criminal justice system here in Minnesota. 651-227-6000, if the course of our conversation sparks some questions or observations. I'm also interested if you've had some involvement in Hennepin County and the criminal justice system there, what your experience was like, and if you serve in it as an attorney, as an administrator, as an advocate. I think it'd be very interesting to hear your view as an advocate. How equitable and how fair? What kinds of reforms do you think we should be examining for Hennepin County's criminal justice system? 800-242-2828. And, you know, I should say the criminal justice system overall, because I'm sure County Attorney Freeman has some views on that as well. 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, and to the phones here to Chelsea in Minneapolis. Hey, Chelsea, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. You know, I was listening and heard the scenario of you being in the Senate in the 80s and changing your behavior when you're on camera. And, you know, I'm a civilian, and I'm the daughter of a police officer, and I have to say that I don't know if, you know, police officers who are meant to protect and serve, if that's the kind of message that I want to hear as a person that relies on the police, that they're going to change their behavior, or if they're just going to be better, show more integrity when they're potentially on camera. So I was just wondering whether or not that is the best message and your thoughts on that.
Mike?
Well, I didn't mean to be flippant. I was trying to basically express a comparison that I thought about. You know, public service is not easy. Our police officers have a very, very difficult job. But we also, part of our jobs is public scrutiny. And if all of us know that the public is watching what we're doing, that just helps us make sure that we have our best foot forward every day. One can say that everyone has bad days, but we need to have as few bad days as possible when we're dealing with people's safety and protection.
I think I hear Chelsea saying, and Mike, it sounds like you agree with this, but we want you to observe the highest standards and principles and ethics, whether we're there to watch or not. And I would think that's what you would want to demand as well.
Exactly. You know, we demand high standards of people like prosecutors and police officers, like lawyers, like preachers. We expect those things, and we should come through with those every day.
Call here from Carlos in Minneapolis. Hi, Carlos. Your question for Mike Freeman.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is why we do not have an education plan on schools for kids, for teenagers, to learn how to deal with police officers, to learn what's a police officer, what's the job, what's the rules, what's the rules when you get pulled over, what's the rules when you talk to an officer, what's the identification that you're supposed to have with you, and all that. As a few days ago, my son got pulled over by the police, and he really didn't know what to do. And he thought it was a good idea to get out of the car and talk to the officer. Which he got yelled about it, and in a very bad experience, Mr. Ed sent back to his car. So I was asked myself the other day, when they learn how to deal with the police, and it's when they get in trouble with the police.
All right. Mike, what would you say? Carlos, thank you.
I think Carlos has got a great idea. I mean, I think that people should have a better understanding of the hard job cops have and how to work with them. And I think that education should come in school, and I think it can be part of a religious education, and families can do it. I know a lot of families talk with their children about how you treat others, be it teachers, be it preachers, be it police officers. And I think that's important. But having it somewhat more systematized, if you will, to have something in school, I think that's a great idea, and I think that could respond to a lot of the tense moments that we see.
I'm sure you're not missing the subtext of Carlos's question either. His son, is a young man, probably of color, and the rules seem different about the way you will interact. The risks, perhaps I should say, are different in the way that you will interact with police officers.
Well, I think that police officers ought to treat all young people, regardless of their race, the same.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that, Mike.
Yeah, but I do understand that there are a lot of African-American families in particular, and some Latino, that are of concern that their kids are treated differently than white kids. And I think society and police officers and prosecutors and judges have work to do on that. But I think the basics are the same. You need to obey the legitimate requests of police officers. And if they say keep your hands up, you keep them up. I don't think that's unique to race. I think that's what all kids have to do.
Yeah, but Mike, when you look at the statistics on cases where particularly young men of color are involved, it's hard to deny that, as we've already said, there's implicit bias involved in those interactions in a way that there might not be if that's a young white man driving the car and about to have an interaction with an officer.
I'm not denying that there's implicit bias, Carrie. What I am saying is young people, regardless of race, need to be polite and respectful to police officers and obey their commands. That's the best way to be able to go home at night. And if the police officer has done something inappropriate, there's cell phones everywhere. There's dash cams, there's body cams. That's the time to work that out after the fact. But you've got to be respectful to the man who carries a gun. Now, that doesn't mean you do anything or everything, but, you need to be respectful there. And that occurs for any kids. Now, are kids of color treated a little differently than police officers? In some cases, they are, and they shouldn't be. But we're working on that, and I think as we deal emphatically with implicit bias, I think we're learning about it.
Can I ask you what your view is of the disparity that you see in the number of people in color of color in our criminal justice, in prisons, in jails? What do you make of that disparity?
It's very difficult to answer that question. You know, the easy way would be for me to say, well, I only deal with the cases that the police bring me, so don't look at me. I think that's disingenuous because we're all part of this system. I think that we need to be aware of the inequities that exist in society in terms of education, economic opportunity, jobs. You know, if a person doesn't have much hope in society, they're much less likely to obey the laws. And we need to make sure that kids in the north side of Minneapolis get the same opportunities to succeed in school and go on in school and have good jobs as the kids do in Eden Prairie. That's what we owe our kids. We're not there yet, and we've got a lot of work to do. And frankly, the criminal justice system can't be tasked with all the responsibilities there.
Yep.
The schools, the taxpayers, the coaches, the Boy Scout leaders, all of us have got to work together to reduce these disparities. And I think we recognize some of the problems. Now we need to do something about it.
Call here from Sarah in Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to? Yeah, what did you want to say?
Yes, I have a question about police training. One of my concerns is how police react to difficult situations, and in fact, I actually experienced one myself. But what I would like to see more of, and this is where I'm heading, is to learn to de-escalate situations rather than escalate situations. I was stopped for speeding on my way to the airport one morning, and I mean, it's a long story. I don't want to go into it, but it was shocking to me that the officer didn't try to de-escalate the situation once she realized that I admitted my mistake. I had all of my driver's license, everything, and she just kept pounding on me. And I'm white, I'm suburban, I have no traffic record. I just couldn't help but to think that other people might be subject to even more difficult situations, far more difficult situations that could lead to violence that I actually, in my little world, experienced myself.
So, Sarah,
that concerns me.
It sounds like you were saying it was, in your view, needlessly adversarial, the interaction.
That's right.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mike, do you have some ideas about that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more that we need more and better police training, and we need to work on the culture in police departments. I got to say that there's been a lot of discussion, particularly in the last 18 months, about more de-escalation training. There's been criticism. The police department spent 50 hours of training on how to use a gun and 5 hours on how to de-escalate, and I think that proportion should be reversed. Not totally, but we need more de-escalation training. I think that some of the reforms that have been announced in Minneapolis police training is good. I think the discussions that are going on at the legislature and elsewhere are good. I was at the Hennepin County Chiefs of Police meeting last week, and they're talking about more training. The training is expensive. And people, you know, the state legislature wants to really do something about the problems of officer-involved shootings and violence. Better training is something they can do. They can mandate it, but, you know, better yet, I think we ought to have statewide training on some folks on de-escalation, on implicit bias, on alternatives to use of deadly force. Many police departments do a good job, but we need to do better. And I learned it from my own office when I thought we were doing pretty good, and I found out Minneapolis police had implicit bias training. I spent some time reading about it, and I hurried and got our office, everyone in the office, to attend and learn it. And we have learned something that's valuable in our work.
Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman with us, if you've just tuned in to the conversation and the continuation of our focus on criminal justice this month. I want to ask you, Mike, about your decision to decline to charge the U of M football players in the sexual assault case, even though a campus report on the incident found that the victim's account was credible. Will you explain why that isn't enough to take these players to court?
In order to charge a person with criminal sexual misconduct, in a situation like this, we have to prove one of several things. We have to prove that there was not consent by the victim to the activity that took place, and we have to be able to prove that by clear and convincing evidence. We do that by statements that she may have made, by actions she may have taken, but we have to prove there's no consent or that she was in a situation like being so inebriated she couldn't give consent, or we have to prove that force was used in the sexual activity. In this case, that evidence didn't exist to the level that we need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The university's standard of proof is a preponderance of the evidence, which is a much lower standard. And they don't have to prove the inability to consent or the lack of consent. What they have to do is to prove the conduct was not the conduct they want of university students or athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a different level of proof. It's a different standard. The criminal justice system has always followed beyond a reasonable doubt, because if we're successful in a prosecution, we are taking a person's liberty away. Liberty is a really important concept for us, and we take people's liberty away because they commit crimes. But if we don't have the evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, we are wrong, just wrong in our duty as prosecutors to bring a case.
You must be concerned that this is precisely the decision and the reasons that you made it. This is precisely the reasons that so many victims of sexual assault decide never to even report it. Is there some kind of reform within this area of the law, this area around sexual assault, that might resolve some of this reluctance of mostly women to come forward about this crime?
We have successfully prosecuted many cases. They don't necessarily get the headlines that the football player's case got.
Wait, you mean of sexual assault?
Absolutely. Rape, okay. Sexual assault, first, second, third degree. We've successfully prosecuted many cases, some very difficult cases. But right now, the good news is the number of organizations like the Aurora Center at the University of Minnesota that exist for outreach to victims and folks who have been in an unwanted sexual activity. And they tell them at the Aurora Center, they talk to them about counseling and medical help, and they leave it up to them whether they want to go to the police or not. You know, almost regardless of how bad or vicious the case was, going to trial as a victim of sexual assault is very hard, and
right,
it takes great courage. Great courage. We have some of the most compassionate victim witness people here and advocates, and it's just horribly difficult to go through one. But sometimes that's exactly what's needed to stop a sexual perpetrator. And we applaud the ones who have courage, but we also have our ethics that under the existing law, we can do what we can do.
Call here from Joseph in Minneapolis. And Joseph, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I do have to say this, that the transparency that Mr. Freeman is talking about is coming about. I work in the system. I work for the Legal Action Center, and he is right. We are seeing more transparency.
Okay.
And we are seeing better officer behavior. So I want to reinforce that. I have to congratulate Hennepin County on those efforts. But I also have to say this, and this is post-conviction information, but it's true throughout the whole system, is that there's a great deal of subjectivity, and specifically when someone is conviction, post-conviction, and there's a pre-sentence investigation report, those reports are very difficult to get a hold of and to read because they're kept private for the judge, the prosecutor, and the attorneys. And I've read many of those reports over many, many years, and some of them are not very accurate, and they can be very, very damaging to a person once they even finish their sentence in terms of rehabilitation, regeneration in the European sense, and moving forward. So I applaud you, Mr. Freeman, in your efforts to create greater transparency. I want to encourage you to spread that word throughout the whole state.
Okay.
It's really, really important.
Joseph, thanks for the call. Mike, something on that?
Well, I appreciate the comment on working on transparency generally. Pre-sentence investigations are after a person has been found guilty or pled guilty, and it's information used to help the judge decide what the sentence should be. By its nature, it needs to be confidential because it goes into medical records, things that would not be admissible in court. It interviews the perpetrator, him or herself. And in the guidepost to make sure it's essentially accurate is the fact that it's available not only to the judge but to the prosecutor and the defense attorney. And many, many times defense attorneys will comment upon what they believe are inaccuracies in that report. So there's a watchdog there to make sure that report. On a bigger issue, you know, when a person has been convicted of crime and done their time, they need to be rehabilitated. They need to have a chance to go back to society. They should have a right to vote if they're no longer in prison. And people, for reasons I can't understand, have refused to support the restore the vote concept. If we want them to be good citizens, we need to treat them like that. We need to help them find a job and the education and have some normalcy in their life. If we don't do that, they're very likely to recidivate. So, you know, 95% of the people who go to prison come out alive. And we need to help them in prison with better classes, get rid of their chemical dependency, and become citizens. And frankly, legislators and legislatures, including ones I served in, were pretty penurious. There just simply haven't been the resources to do the rehab we need to do.
I was going to wait to take this call, Mike, but given what you just said, I'm going to bring State Senator Scott Dibble onto the line. I don't want to wait on that. Senator, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Great. Thanks, Carrie.
I know you were calling for something else, but you just heard what Mike Freeman said about the funds, the appropriations available to help usher people back into their neighborhoods and society. What do you think? Is he right?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's extremely important. I completely agree. We had a long conversation last year, the Prison Population Task Force. Rather than spending $400 and some million, as was proposed, to expand a couple of our prison facilities, it was thought that it's probably better to see what we could do to bring down our prison population and make sure that folks who were getting out weren't returning, and folks who were in were getting the kinds of services they need before they were even released from prison. A much, much better use of money.
Mike, is that acceptable to you, or what would you say?
No, I think Senator Dibble is right, and he's been supportive of additional resources for rehabilitation, as I was when I was in the legislature. But there's a lot of demands on the tax dollar. I think Scott and his colleagues are working, trying to make sure that only people who go to prison must go to prison, was reflected in their passage of a drug resentencing bill that I supported, which reduced the sentences for addicts and saved a number of prison beds into the future. You know, I've been working on that 6 years, Senator Dibble and some of his colleagues had, and I'm glad we got a bipartisan bill through last time to get it done. Now we need to implement that fully.
So, Senator, you were calling about a different bill on officer-involved shootings, is that right?
That's right, and Mike and I have discussed this now. This is a bill I introduced last year, just reintroduced it a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
What that would do is, in the interest of greater transparency, greater trust for these investigations when there is an officer-involved shooting or an incident where there's great bodily harm or death that results to a member of the public, rather than investing that investigation in the hands of the local county prosecutor and or the grand jury process, establish an independent investigator, an independent office at the state level to really get to the truth of the matter, to the extent possible, conduct that investigation with greater transparency, and make sure that, like I said earlier, the interests of justice are served.
So you would take it out of someone like Mike Freeman's hands. Mike, what do you think of that?
Well, you know, Senator Dibble is correct. We have talked about that, and that issue has come up. Certainly, that's an alternative, and it would remove it from any alleged or purported bias that a local prosecutor could have. It would also take away the accountability of that prosecutor for the decision he makes. Look, these are some of the most difficult cases we ever get. And to be able to say someone else has to do it is tempting. But I think the existing conflict of interest laws and practices, I mean, all the county attorneys share cases with each other when there's a conflict of interest. We simply would not take a case of a police officer that we knew well and we worked with all the time. We simply would farm that out. But, for example, in the two officers in the Jamar Clark case, they were not well known to this office at all. And the people who made the decisions, who gave me the closest advice, didn't know them at all, and I didn't either. I think having me do it means I can be accountable, and I go to community meetings, and sometimes they listen to what I suggest. Sometimes they don't, but that's their right. So I think there are trade-offs in that, and I think I suggested to Senator Dibble that if he'd like me to be part of the legislative discussion on that, I'd be happy to do it.
Senator, is that answer acceptable enough, or do you still feel that an independent office is needed? Oh, we might have lost him.
Yeah,
maybe.
And I could say that Scott and I really did. I knew he was going to introduce this, and I said, you know, it's a great way to have some dialogue. I think we should have it.
Okay. County Attorney Freeman with us from Hennepin County this morning as we continue our criminal justice series this month. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we're going to come back, and I want to talk to him about plea bargaining. And we'll play a little bit of the discussion that we had about that on our Friday roundtable. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Russian President Vladimir Putin is accusing the Obama administration of trying to undermine President-elect Donald Trump by spreading fake allegations. Putin, speaking at a news conference in Moscow, said a purported collection of damaging information about Trump was part of the effort by the Obama administration to undermine the legitimacy of the president-elect despite his convincing victory. Putin dismissed as fake the unverified allegations about Trump's activities at a Moscow hotel. Trump has rejected the allegations as fake news. Donald Trump is shrugging off polls that show him with low approval ratings heading into his inauguration. The president-elect tweeted today, the same people who did the phony election polls and were so wrong are now doing approval rating polls. He added the polls are rigged just like before. Neighbors of the accused Istanbul nightclub attacker say they were shocked to learn he lived among them. Turkish police late yesterday captured the man who authorities say killed 39 people and wounded scores of others in a New Year's Eve attack. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility. Neighbors in an Istanbul apartment complex were stunned to find the building at the heart of a large-scale police operation. And Malaysia Airlines says the search for its missing Flight 370 has come to an end. Officials say the search has been thorough and comprehensive. The underwater search ended today after 3 years of effort failed to find a trace of the plane. It disappeared in March of 2014 with 239 people on board. The airline says it hopes that new information will come to light and that the plane will eventually be found. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:44.
Hi, it's Maria, Maria Hinojosa from Latino USA, the NPR program heard right here each week. We all love great stories, whether it's a book or a movie or, yeah, on a radio show. And great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you each week. Stories from the heart, stories that make you think, help inspire you, and maybe even get you a little angry. So if you haven't tuned in lately, I invite you to stop by. Thanks for listening.
We have special coverage of the inauguration planned on Friday. You'll hear that from NPR News. And I want to remind you, you might have seen some of the news about this, a new national show called Indivisible for the first 100 days of the Trump administration. I'm involved in it on Thursday nights. It will come from different parts of the country, and you'll be seeing more news about that. But it's a call-in show, 7 p.m. through the week, coming out of Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday nights. More details on that, but I hope you'll, set your clock and call in and listen.
Support for this program comes from the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, investing in innovation to drive gender equity through grant-making, research, and policy, providing leadership to end sex trafficking in Minnesota. WFMN.org.
Back to our criminal justice series, I want to let you know that next Tuesday we will be talking about criminal justice in the Native American community on reservations and off. That's next Tuesday at 9 a.m. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman with us this hour. Mike, I want to ask you about something that came up in this roundtable discussion that I had last Friday. We had public defender Maria Mitchell, federal judge John Thunheim, and Washington County Attorney Pete Orpat. And we were talking about why there are so many plea bargains. They're in the 90% range in the system, and whether the reason is that prosecutors go for too high of a charge to give themselves room to bargain down. And I want you to hear a little bit of the conversation around that.
We charge the behavior that we think we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. We start there. Then the defendant comes and says, "You're right, I am guilty. But here's what was going on in my life. This is what caused it. This is what I'm willing to do to restore the victim whole." And we're open to having that dialogue with their defense attorneys.
Is that usually how it goes, Maria?
I think you see both. I think you see what Pete is talking about in terms of taking into account the defendant's side of the story. They may say, "Well, yes, I'm guilty of this, but not guilty of all of these other things." Or, "Yes, I did this, but I was in a psychotic episode, or I was high on drugs and I'm in treatment now. And so we're gonna give you some benefit from that." But then there's the other side of it, too, is, "I just don't want to go to prison. I didn't do this, but they're offering me probation."
Michael, pick up on what you're hearing there in that roundtable.
Well, I think Pete Orpat has very aptly stated what we prosecutors hear and try to do. I mean, as we talked earlier, our charging standard is very high. We have to have sufficient admissible evidence to prove the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That's very high, and it should be. And so the cases that prosecutors charge, and I can speak most directly for what we do in this office, are pretty solid cases. Now, sometimes evidence changes. Sometimes we make mistakes. We openly acknowledge that. And we dismiss things, or we agree with the lesser included offense, and sometimes that means probation instead of prison. But I think that the system is pretty fairly done when you think about the volume of cases that we have. And you know, the other thing that happens in the plea bargaining world is skilled prosecutors and skilled defense attorneys know how to review a file and to figure out the chances of the person being found guilty. They're pretty high. The defense attorneys would like to get a deal for their client, and that's part of the system. And frankly, we need to have the plea negotiations because the system would get terribly bogged down otherwise.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you about, though. I mean, when you see plea bargain rates at upwards of 90-something percent in county systems and in federal systems, I hear what you're saying about we need this to lubricate the wheels of justice. But does that seem too high? And do the incentives, as Maria was raising there, mean that people who would normally feel like they had a right to go to trial, the incentives are so overwhelming that they end up making a decision that may not be in their best interest?
Well, I believe I can only really comment about the Minnesota system and particularly the Hennepin County system. My understanding of the federal system is the incentive to plead is overwhelming, and I think it's a bit. The prosecutors, frankly, and you'll be amazed to hear a prosecutor say that, have too much power in the federal system. I wish the judges had more, and I wish, frankly, more cases could go to trial because I think they should.
Wait a minute. You that said in the federal system.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota is overcharging. But the temptation to do that in the practices I understand elsewhere, it's not as much a level playing field as I'd like it. Now, I don't think, well, first off, you know, we have a successful prosecution rate either in terms of plea or conviction in the low 90% of all our cases. I think that's about right. If it was much higher than that, then we're not charging some of the tougher cases we should. Well, and if it was much lower, we're charging too many cases.
Yeah, but,
so I
but,
think that's about right.
But what I'm asking is that successful prosecution rate includes plea bargains, right? Because you call that
exactly.
A conviction. Well, so when more than 90% of the defendants in the system are pleading out, is there, which allows you to say, yes, we got a conviction in that case, is there a, Does this need further scrutiny to say, are people sometimes acting against their own interests in not taking a case to trial? Maria Mitchell thinks so.
Well, she's a public defender, yes. And you know, and that's their side, and I respect it. And of course, they're going to advocate for that. That's their job, and that's the reason they're public defenders. I'm not troubled with, you know, I think I haven't looked at how many trials we've had last year, but we had significant numbers, and some of our people try 8, 10, 12, 15 cases a year. We don't charge a case unless the evidence is overwhelming that the person did it. Our kind of weeding out of the cases that shouldn't be part of this is done by us and by the police, because they don't bring us cases that they don't think we can prove. And between the two of us, we screen out a lot of cases. Now, there are cases when the jury decides that the person is not guilty. That's the system. You're not going to hear me complain about it. I may disagree with their determination on an individual case, but that's the system. And if a guy who works in the system can't believe in it, I shouldn't be here, and I believe in it. But I don't think we plead too many cases. I think it's about right. And there's always someone who, you know, an example, someone who believes they didn't do anything when the evidence overwhelmingly shows they do. So there's always going to be some complaints about the system, and we accept that.
I want to ask you about bail. This is something else that has come up in our series and whether it's fair. You have people who sit in jail pre-trial, so they're already serving time even though they're presumed innocent because they can't come up with, you know, what, $2,000 to post bail. Do you think the overall system of bail is fair?
I think the system of bail, particularly misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, needs to be reviewed. With this caveat, under our present system, the system in Hennepin and Ramsey County means the county attorneys, Mr. Choi and myself, only do adult felonies. And most of our cases are serious enough that some bail is appropriate. And we set bail for two reasons. Number one, to make sure the person returns to be adjudicated and makes their court appearances. And secondly, for public safety. And the big ones you hear about is when somebody's killed somebody or maliciously raped somebody. And those, the bail is higher. The real question is, you know, setting bail even at $500 or $1,000 for some people means they may well not be able
exactly.
to make that amount and get out.
Exactly.
And I think, frankly, we need to look at that. You know, people can abuse this. If they get out and they disappear, then they've gotten away with it. Or if they don't disappear, they go out and perpetrate additional crimes during the period of time. You have to weigh that against a person who's just as indigent and may well have committed a crime or hasn't, but don't want to plea early on and wants to have their day in trial, which they're entitled to, but just can't make the amount of money. I think we need to revisit some of that because I think the problem, you know, every once in a while we need to revisit this because we need to make sure people, we don't have debtors' prisons in America, and we shouldn't.
So as the system, you're saying we need to revisit it, but I'm asking, as the system stands today, do you think it's fair?
I think the system, as far as felons, it is fair. Again, I'm not passing the buck. I've got a big enough job to worry about what I do, and I think our setting of bail in felony cases is pretty good.
Mike, I appreciate the time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Freeman is the Hennepin County attorney and part of our criminal justice system. And you can find the other discussions. You can find that Friday roundtable and some of our other discussions on criminal justice on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.